is. We got time. Not reversed. Everything's looked residing.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for March 9, 2023, and we're blessed that technology finally got us all so we can look at each other, and we have three matters on our oral calendar, two non-oral matters. This first matter is A220648, State of Minnesota versus Ronald Joseph Hansen. We are recording this proceeding, as you heard just a moment ago, and in fact, it'll be on the judicial branch's website typically within a day, and so any other recording is prohibited. We do ask counsel to identify themselves for the record, who you represent when you begin your comments, and you should see in the corner somewhere the 15 minutes, which each will be allotted, and then 5 minutes appellant will have for rebuttal. So we'll start with appellant's counsel. You may identify yourself and then proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sam Luwagi, representing appellant Ronald Joseph Hansen. I do apologize for those technical difficulties. Guess we bit off more than we could chew trying to present from a conference room. As I said, I represent the appellant Ronald Joseph Hansen. The law enforcement officers in this case who pulled Mr. Hansen over, asked him to exit his vehicle, and conducted a dog sniff of that vehicle were acting on a hunch. They were acting on rumors and innuendo. They were acting on anonymous tips. What they were not acting on at any point leading up to their dog sniff of Mr. Hansen's vehicle was objectively reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity. Now, the officer's suspicion of Mr. Hansen rests almost entirely on his brief stop at a house in Breezy Point that was under surveillance at the time by the Crow Wing County Sheriff's Office. But Mr. Hansen's visit to this house contributes nothing to any reasonable suspicion of him. I think it's important to look closely at exactly what the officers knew about this house and the homeowner at the time of Mr. Hansen's visit to the house. The officers had received an anonymous tip about the occupant of the house being involved in selling drugs from the house. Investigator Stanley admitted that he had no information to confirm the reliability of that anonymous tip on page 19 of the omnibus transcript. Officers had received information from the postal inspector about packages that, quote, appeared to have been purchased through the dark web, end quote. That's page 13 of the omnibus transcript. Now, that obviously is entirely vague. The record has no testimony as to what the dark web is.
So, Mr. Luwagi, so have we abandoned, I mean, the first part of your argument, I thought, was, you know, it wasn't raining, and so there was no reasonable suspicion for the traffic stop. So now I got the impression you're shifting from, well, you tell me, but now I think your argument is shifting to whether or not the stop, the initial stop was valid, there was no grounds to expand the search. Is that right? Or so, well, you tell me.
Certainly, Your Honor, we're certainly not intending to abandon or, move on from any arguments we made in the briefing. I think that we certainly stand on that initial argument. I was wanting to spend as much time as I could focusing on the lack of reasonable suspicion of drug-related activity and thus the expansion of the stop. But if the court has questions on the...
I understand your argument, and I did look at the video, and I agree with you. It wasn't raining mm-hmm. when, I forgot his name, the second officer actually who conducted the stop stopped the car. I will say I did think, you know, through my nearsighted eyes, that there did seem to be some water on the door handle or underneath the door handle, and there did seem to be water sort of when you open the door on the driver's side in the bottom, which would have indicated that it might have been raining in the past. But, the initial officer who saw, I think it was Stanley is his name.
Correct.
You know, he did say it was raining and, you know, the taillights were not on, and the taillights are, you know, have to be on when the headlights are on. But in any event, my point was, you know, in looking at the case law, even if the first officer had been mistaken as to whether or not the headlights were on, case law under State v. Liguori says that, you know, an officer's, you know, if an officer observes a violation of a traffic law, however insignificant, the officer's objective basis for the stop, an officer's mistake as to the interpretation of the law cannot form the basis. However, honest, reasonable mistakes of fact are unobjectionable under the Fourth Amendment. So even if the first officer, as I understand the law, had been wrong, i.e. he did have his headlights on, it doesn't matter. So, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I have no problem with the stop. So as to the expansion then, I mean, I'll just sort of be devil's advocate. I mean, you know, if there's a basis for the stop, then we look at, okay, what did they know to expand the stop? And what they knew was, okay, the postal inspector had said there's stuff being delivered there. This guy went there for less than 15 minutes, ostensibly to see a friend who turns out wasn't there, and drove several hours away. You know, then when he stopped, you know, they start asking him questions, and they find out he's on probation, and we can get an argument about, you know, what he said in terms of the probation, et cetera, but he was on probation. He apparently may have misrepresented what the conditions were, you know, plus there was the nervousness. Why isn't that enough for a dog sniff? I mean, it seems to me, taking that all, the totality of the circumstances together, I think that might have been enough for a dog sniff. So why am I wrong, sir?
Well, Your Honor, I think starting from the point of what you mentioned about, and again, as to the initial stop, because we're, you know, with limited time, I want to focus on the suspicion of reasonable or suspicion of drug activity with the expansion of the stop, rest on the arguments in the brief. As to the reasonableness of the stop itself. I think it's important to start with what officers knew or had reason to suspect about the house itself, because everything kind of flows from Mr. Hansen's visit to that house. I think, you know, the record makes clear that that was the true reason for the stop, and a large portion of their suspicion of him, even, you know, if you taking into account some of the things that they talked about after the stop. And so what they knew about the house is that there had been an anonymous tip about the occupant, which they admit that there was no information to confirm the reliability. A wholly vague innuendo about the dark web, which there's no explanation about what the dark web is, how anybody could determine that a package came from the dark web, what significance that should have. I think it's just, you know, that's kind of as vague and speculative as it gets. And then as a result of that information, officers spent weeks at their own admission surveilling the house. And all they could testify that they saw, this is on transcript pages 17 and 18, is the homeowner walking to a gas station nearby, walking to the restaurant where he worked, and taking possession of a package delivered to his house. So that's it. The anonymous tip, the dark web suggestion or innuendo, and, you know, observations of a guy's daily routines are all that's in the record about this, you know, quote unquote suspected drug house. This court has ruled that when there's no evidence that drugs have ever been present in a suspected drug house, proximity to that house, quote, contributed nothing, end quote.
Let's throw the drug house out the window.
Sure.
Okay. I mean, why wasn't there, and there's lots of case law and these things are all fact specific, but at the end of the day, you know, they stop him. They start asking him questions. He admits he's on probation for a drug offense. He appears to be nervous. He may have misrepresented the conditions of his probation. I'm unclear as to why that might not have been enough for a drug test, a drug sniff.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think, first of all, I think it, not that necessarily this is what you meant, but I think it's well put to throw the drug house out the window, because that's, you know, what I under the case law, what I think the court should do with that information. Then I think the key moment in the case is when Officer Hall asks Mr. Hansen to step out of his vehicle. And then, you know, because from that point, he tells him, you look nervous. Is there anything illegal in the car? That's a clear expansion of the scope of that traffic stop. It has nothing to do with his headlights or taillights. It has nothing to do with the rain. So that moment needed to be justified by independent, reasonable suspicion. Even before you get into what Your Honor was discussing about the probation discussion and that kind of thing. So again, you know, I think it's important to stop and look at exactly what Officer Hall knew at the moment that he asked Mr. Hansen to step out of the vehicle. As we just discussed, the stop at that surveilled house contributed nothing to that reasonable, or to the reasonableness of that suspicion. It's a zero in the analysis of the reasonable suspicion. So the only facts that objectively contributed to the officer's suspicion were that Mr. Hansen was driving a vehicle not registered to him. We had testimony about that. Of course, Officer Hall quickly learned that it was registered to his mother. So I don't think, you know, driving one's mom's car is an indicator of criminal activity.
Well, considering my daughter does that all the time, I would agree with you.
I'm glad we're in agreement on that piece. And as you mentioned, there was that Mr. Hansen appeared nervous, according to Officer Hall, but that is based on his purportedly fumbling with the window when the officer approached and speaking quietly to the officer. Those are not objective indicators of the kind of nervousness that suggests criminal activity. These are kind of indicators of a relatively shy person. I think if you watch the body camera footage, I would submit to the court that there's nothing unusual about Mr. Hansen's demeanor. You know, he's deferential to a police officer. He's polite. He's not stammering or, you know.
Well, what about the reasons for him driving in the neighborhood to begin with? I thought, you know, Sartell's 1.5 hours away. You know, he seemed to not have a great explanation as to why he's, you know, driving in this area.
Sure. And, I think that's an appropriate question, because I think we've gotten down to that's the kind of the one remaining fact that Officer Hall had to justify suspicion, was that this guy drove to meet a friend without a plan. And, you know, that Officer Hall found that unusual. And it may be unusual to Officer Hall. It may be unusual to the court. But it's a leap to suggest that that indicates criminal or drug related activity.
Mr. Lawaji, let me ask you, what about the body of law, though? I mean, you're talking about these individual factors and considering them individually, when I think really we look at the circumstances from the totality of the circumstances and really what was known to that officer at the time. And there's this body of law that says police officers, based upon their experience and training, can come to conclusions or inferences that might well escape an untrained citizen. What do we do with that body of law in analyzing this?
Your Honor, the police officers can come to conclusions based on their training and their experience, but it's still, you know, there's along the same lines, a body of case law suggesting that they still have to have more than just a hunch. They have to have articulable facts that reasonably suggest criminal activity. And what we're left with here is the fact that an officer found it unusual that this guy drove a while to meet a friend without making a plan. I understand that we're looking at the totality of the circumstances, but even in the totality of the circumstances, we've got this suspected drug house with absolutely no credible information about drug activity. We've got nervousness that's, as we just discussed, is not really, again, it's not the type of thing that, it's not the type of specific fact that, you know, are objectively points to any criminal activity. We're left with it with an unusual plan for the day. And it's just not enough to objectively, reasonably suspect that there's drug activity afoot. And I think, you know, what's clear is that this was all, this search of this vehicle was predetermined from the moment Mr. Hansen left the house that was under surveillance. If he hadn't made a stop at that house and he had just been pulled over for driving in the rain without his headlights on, the nervousness that he displayed would not have suggested criminal activity. The fact that, you know, he was driving to see a friend without having talked to the friend ahead of time is not an indicator of criminal activity. These are hunches. These are anonymous tips, information. This is innuendo, but it's not concrete, reasonable suspicion. And I believe I'm, you know, running out of time. I think I'll cede the floor here for the remaining 10 seconds of my argument.
Very good. And you will have 5 minutes, of course, a rebuttal, a counsel for respondent. You may identify yourself and then begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lindsay Lindstrom, and I represent the state of Minnesota respondent in today's matter. To start with the stop, there was reasonable suspicion for the stop. The standard for stopping a vehicle is very low. It's a very low hurdle, so to speak. Investigator Stanley saw that it was raining. He saw there were no taillights when the vehicle backed out of the residence. If you review the video, and I understand everyone's reviewed it, you can tell on the ground there's appearance of water having been on the ground. The vehicles are wet. You can see the clouds in the sky consistent with the rain. And then partway through the stop, the rain starts trickling down, then it builds up and it's full rain and back to trickling, which is consistent with the testimony from Officer Hall that it was raining intermittently. And collective knowledge, you have multiple officers, they can use their knowledge together.
Investigators. I believe the first officer testified he did not, I assume because of where his car was positioned, he did not see whether or not there were headlights on. Is there evidence in the record that either if the taillights are not on, that means your headlights are not on, or is there evidence in the record that indicates the statute requires both your headlights and taillights to be on when it's raining?
And Your Honor, I would submit that the statute requires both the headlights and the taillights. And my understanding from the testimony and the conversation, even with appellant, is he had the auto light feature on. So if it was bright enough out, the taillights would not have been activated. So Investigator Stanley wasn't in a position to observe the headlights, but he did observe the taillights were not activated. And the conversation with Officer Hall and appellant confirmed that.
Ms. Lindstrom, I'll take the question a little different route and presume that the court found credible that indeed the lights were not on when it was raining, when the first officer observed the car. My question for you more is the connection of the collective knowledge principle to this particular stop. And am I correct first on my question that it appears the judge found credible the evidence that at the time of this actual stop, it was not raining. It had rained a little bit before, had been raining off and on, but at the time of the stop, it was not raining. Hence, at the time of the stop, it would not be a violation of law not to have your headlights on. Did I read the order correctly that that's true?
I believe that's what the judge found, that it wasn't actively raining at the time Officer Hall stopped the vehicle. Okay.
So my question is on the collective knowledge, the cases you've cited, and they're the ones I'm familiar with, generally are the alcohol related. A person leaves a bar drunk, a confidential informant might say, an officer earlier saw a car weaving all over the road, both of which would imply an ongoing criminal offense of driving while impaired. And so that knowledge combined with what the stopping officer then observes collectively results in a stop. But I wonder if that applies to a scenario like this, and I'll just pose a hypothetical. Let's assume when the first officer left, the sun is just coming up. It wasn't quite up, and so a headlight needs to be on. By the time the second officer stops the vehicle, the sun is out and a headlight doesn't need to be on. Do you believe the principle of collective knowledge would allow for a traffic stop, even if earlier it was a violation of law and that officer, for whatever reason, chose not to stop, but now at the time of the stop, there's no unlawful behavior?
Well, I think in this case, we're talking about a situation where a violation has occurred and officers can stop for a pass violation. Investigator Stanley personally didn't stop because he was in an unmarked squad. He didn't have a video. He was in plain clothes. So it's common practice to have a so uniform.
If a car is seen with headlights out during the night and 5 hours later, I'm exaggerating my hypothetical, the officer who stops the vehicle talked to the officer 5 hours earlier that the light was off, could stop that vehicle under the collective knowledge principle?
Well, I think at that point we wouldn't know that the driver was the same driver.
The importance to you is time and description of the vehicle, perhaps.
And in this case, yes, Investigator Stanley was still following the vehicle, keeping it in his view. And I would believe that if the officer had been right there waiting, the stop would have happened immediately. But that wasn't the circumstance here. So he radioed right away and said, hey, he's driving without his taillights on. Can you please stop him for
Lindstrom, me? Does the record indicate approximately how much time passed between when Stanley saw the no lights on and when the vehicle was stopped by the second officer?
I know that it's there. I don't have that at my fingertips.
Well, generally speaking, I mean, are we talking like 15 minutes? Are we talking about an hour? I mean, I'm just kind of trying to get a feel for the temporal time issue.
Certainly. And I believe it was within 10 to 15 minutes, but I just don't have that in front of me right now. I was taking...
We'll figure it out. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Sorry. So moving past the stop, arguably due to the low standard, the stop is an appropriate stop. Prior to the stop, as I know you've already discussed, there was the information about the house. The investigator Stanley did testify that the dark web is used in large part to purchase illegal controlled substances. So you have the postal master saying he's delivered multiple of these suspicious packages with the dark web. The investigator had been surveilling the house, had seen the homeowner pick up at least one of those packages. And then you move on to this very...
Ms. Lindstrom, could Stanley, I think that's the first officer, could he have arrested Mr. Hansen when he left the house?
No, I don't, he would not have had, in my opinion, he wouldn't have had probable cause to arrest him when he left the house for a visit to the house.
So the stop is based on the reasonable suspicion of the traffic violation. And then we go to the expansion of the stop, which only needs to be supported by reasonable suspicion for a dog sniff. Would that be a fair statement of the law, Ms. Lindstrom?
Yes.
Okay. So why don't you, I know it's in the briefs, which we've all read, sum up succinctly, if you can, please, the grounds to expand the stop to get to the dog sniff, please.
Certainly. We have the drug trafficking house with the investigator who's surveilling, the postal inspector delivering the suspicious packages from the dark web, and you have a vehicle that is registered to a woman driven by a man, and investigator Stanley testified that this can be a common way of drug traffickers to have law enforcement not run a plate and see who the driver is, as the driver is someone other than the vehicle driver. The stop was one of the very typical quick 5 to 10 minutes in and out. He went in the home, he came out of the home and left again, which is very consistent with all of the training and experience the investigator had in drug trafficking and drug dealing. Then when Officer Hall stopped the vehicle and spoke with appellant, he did have the 1.5 hour drive to visit a friend that he had no idea was going to be there, and ultimately the friend worked. Now that is inconsistent with everyday life. That's consistent with the drug dealing suspicion or the drug engaging in a drug activity, but wholly inconsistent with everyday life to travel essentially 3 hours round trip without any idea that the individual would be there. The nervousness also is a factor.
I have three children, and they were teenagers, and I can assure you, making crazy drives was not out of the question in their lives. So I don't know if I'd agree with that, but anyway, he's not a teenager. So.
And in addition to the mumbling and the other indicia of nervousness, Officer Hall had specifically given the appellant instructions to stand at the car. Instead, he leaned on the bumper. Instead, he's wandering around, pacing back and forth.
Ms. Lindstrom, could I? It might actually dovetail what Judge Conley is getting at. Mr. Lawaji made a point earlier that it necessarily, all these inferences that were drawn necessarily requires the previous information, which his argument as a matter of law doesn't, it means nothing. Let me just ask it this way. Would you agree that all of these inferences necessarily require that information about the dark web? In other words, that, because absent that, any driver stopped for just about any reason might exhibit all of these, and it wouldn't give rise to a suggestion of criminal behavior.
Well, and I guess the question is at what point? I think it's entirely relevant that the investigator was watching this house with the information that he had. And without having that information, it still would be in my opinion, incredibly suspicious to have someone drive that distance, although they arguably have an innocent explanation. But in this case, we adding everything up together and looking at the officer's training experience, all of these innocence factors, when you put them together, rise to the level of the totality of the circumstances, giving this reasonable suspicion that there was drug activity afoot.
And that's why I wanted to clarify, obviously your belief is that's important, relevant information of drug activity to begin with, as opposed to what Mr. Lawaji is referring to. But your point being is that you start from that house surveillance and then add the subsequent inferences drawn also from the stop. That's a necessary part, in other words, of your argument.
I would agree with that.
Thank you.
And then as already discussed, there's the probation situation, drug probation, minimizing the conditions of probation, as well as when the officer asked about the illegal items in the vehicle, the response was not directly tied to the question. It was, oh, I've been sober for this long, and going on and on, kind of in a different path. The officer also had testified that appellants would often kind of attempt to take the conversation away from what the officer was trying to direct them to. So it's an additional factor involved.
Counsel, would you remind me again what he I believe, what was he on probation for?
Her drug possession.
Thank you.
By the way, Ms. Lindstrom, on that, and I think that was a question that was asked during the Mr. Lawaji's presentation as well. Would asking the question of one's on probation be proper in a normal traffic stop alone, or is, again, that's here a proper question because of the earlier drug house surveillance presumption that's made and adds to it?
I think the officers need to have some basis to ask for whether an individual is on probation. Your basic 5 mile over speed stop, I wouldn't think without more would make it inappropriate to ask that question.
So here, the point being, if you add all that up and you add that to it, now we're getting, if we're not already there, we're certainly real close to the reasonable suspicion to request the dog sniff at that point.
Right. That would be the state's position here.
Thank you.
Well, I guess members of the panel, unless there's additional questions, that concludes my presentation.
I don't see any. Thank you. And counsel for appellant, you will now have 5 minutes. And as soon as you see it on the clock there, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will touch briefly on the initial stop argument because we didn't have time to get to that in my initial presentation, and it was discussed in Ms. Lindstrom's presentation. And to answer the court's earlier question, there was testimony in the record that it was a few short minutes, I believe is the quote, it's somewhere in the transcript, from the time that Investigator Stanley saw Mr. Hansen driving purportedly without his headlights on and at the time that the stop was initiated. And I think that's important because...
Well, I mean, that doesn't help you, does it?
Well...
I think that makes your case worse.
Well, Your Honor, I think
to toss this.
You know, I disagree with that, Your Honor, because I think what that suggests, the few short minutes, you know, we've got a stop initiated at a time with sunny skies, no raindrops on a windshield, no indication that it had just been raining within the last few short minutes. And we've got testimony that a few short minutes before that it was raining from an officer who also testified that it was raining throughout the traffic stop, which I think we all agree is not true. And so I think the discussion about the temporal connection previously was going towards whether it was the same driver in the car. I don't think there's any dispute that Mr. Hansen was the one driving the car at all times relevant here. But the fact that this time was so short shows that the reality is that, you know, the state has not established that it was actually raining at any time that an officer observed Mr. Hansen. We've got Investigator Stanley testifying that it was raining.
Mr. Loaggi, maybe I misread the... I thought it was really, or at least by the judge's order, found credible it was raining at the time Officer Stanley... That was the whole point about the lights. Did I misread that correctly? And so, then the road was wet when the stop occurred. And it's only a few minutes later, but have I misunderstood those facts?
excuse me. I don't know that an express, or a specific factual finding was made regarding whether it was raining. The trial court held as a matter of law that testimony of the office of the two officers combined established reasonable suspicion, and it's our argument that the only evidence that it was raining is the testimony of Investigator Stanley, which at least as regards to whether it was raining during the stop is directly contradicted by the testimony of his fellow officer and by the squad car footage. But I think what's important, or you know, what I want to focus on now is, you know, moving past the justification for the initial stop. And again, there was discussion about the probation discussion. I think I would really like to focus on the time period beginning from when the stop was made and ending at when Officer Hall asked Mr. Hansen, excuse me, to leave the vehicle. That's a clear expansion of the stop. It's clearly required reasonable suspicion on its own to do that. Before we even got to, you know, was he dishonest about his probation? Was he wandering around by the squad car? All that stuff.
I imagine, Mr. Wadger, you would not say he was being dishonest about his probation. He was simply articulating the most important conditions of his probation.
Correct. Thank you for clarifying that, Your Honor.
To help out someone in trouble.
I was trying to clarify what I saw as the state's argument that he was being, or trying to characterize what I saw as the state's argument that he was being dishonest about his probation, which he was not. But even to get to that point required reasonable suspicion to ask him to get out of the car. And as I discussed previously, there just isn't that there. And, you know, that's where the key decision lies in this case.
Very good. And you are within 16 seconds, so I suspect, and I didn't hear anything more, that you're complete with your statement.
If there's no further questions from the panel, then I'll finish.
Very good. Thank you. And appreciate the comments of both counsel, the briefing, answers to our questions today. We will now take the matter under advisement and issue a ruling accordingly within 90 days. You each have a good day.
I do have to ask, Mr. Loaggi, are you related to Mr. Vincent Loaggi?
Yes.
Well, please give him my very warmest regards.
Will do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. This is the second of three oral arguments that we have this morning at March 9, Judges Conley and Floria joining me, Judge Sleater. Today we are recording this proceeding, and so any other recording is prohibited, but informationally, for those who are listening, it will be available on the court's website within 24 hours typically. This matter is file A221639, Patrick Dineen, appellant versus Timothy Melby et al., Adventures Inc., respondents. And you'll each have 15 minutes. You should see the time clock on a corner of your screen somewhere. Do keep an eye on that, of course. We do ask that you identify yourself, your name for the record, and whom you represent when you begin. We will proceed with counsel for appellant. You may identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Patrick Dineen. I'm the plaintiff in this case. I'm also a Minnesota licensed attorney. I'm an officer of the court. Thus far in the proceedings, I have been representing myself, including today. The case we have for you today, it's the district court judge, Judge Johnson, terminated my case on granting a defense motion to dismiss. There's two points of law I want to start with. I'm sure none of this is new to Your Honors. This is basic motion to dismiss law. First point I want to make is Minnesota is a liberal pleading state, which my understanding of what that means is that Minnesota law favors determinations on the merits and not on technicalities. I don't believe there is a deficiency in the amended complaint that justified the motion to dismiss, but to the extent there is, or Your Honors take issue with something that wasn't sufficiently addressed, The remedy there would be to provide myself with an opportunity to correct that through an amended complaint rather than to terminate the case. The second point I want to make is that the allegations as stated in the complaint is what controls in a motion to dismiss. In this case, the defendant came forward with not just its own version of facts, but false, unsupported facts, which the district court ended up being persuaded by and adopting. And amongst those is that the representation concluded on the exact same date that a register of actions in the underlying litigation concluded many years ago. That's not what the complaint states. The complaint states that the representation continued for years following that. The underlying litigation involved the cancellation of a contract for deed that was held by Adventures on three commercial properties in Elysian, Minnesota, and there was substantial post-litigation activities with the clearing of titles and sales of the first and then the second and then the third of those lots over time.
Mr. Dineen, can I ask you, you use the phrase technicality, and I didn't read the judge's order that way, so I don't know if you were just giving us the law on that in the event we read it that way, but am I not correct that with regard to Timothy Melby and his wife, that the primary focus of the judge's decision is there was no allegation in the complaint, the amended complaint, that they were a part of the initial legal contract agreement, the retainer, essentially, I'll call it a retainer agreement for lack of a better phrase. And that's even separate from statute of limitations and any other defense, simply found no allegation that they were a part of the agreement or subsequently ratified the agreement. So I assume you would agree that's more than a technicality. That's a matter of substance in looking at your amended complaint. So we can simply review your amended complaint and see if we agree or disagree with that substantive analysis.
I agree with that. Tim Melby was an officer of Adventures at all relevant times, including when this underlying litigation commenced. He was really my main contact and how Dale Melby and I ended up having the relationship that we did. So Tim Melby was involved in this throughout the proceedings and in the post-litigation proceedings in his capacity as an officer of Adventures. Once Dale Melby passed away, Tim Melby and I, we were in regular contact, and my position is that he ratified or adopted the obligation as his own. And the most pointed piece of evidence that's part of the record is a 2019 email that is recited in the amended complaint, and it's also addressed in the briefs, in which I bring up to Tim Melby, do you want me to file a claim in your mother's estate for this? And he says, no, I don't want you to do that. I'm negotiating with the estate for me, myself, Tim Melby, to take care of this outside of the estate proceeding. Weaving through all of this, you don't have it in the file. I realize we're confined to what's in the record, but the amended complaint does reference a deed that was given to me on an Ely property to secure what was left of the balance. That there was a larger balance, and it was paid down with two payments, one of $10,000 from Dale Melby, a successive one after he passed away by Tim Melby of $5,000. And the
would you agree that your qualification there, it kind of ends that analysis? In other words, there's no evidence in the record what that deed means, what it purports to do, how it ties in with the original agreement with Tim Melby's dad. And so hence the district court didn't make any references to it, and we should not as well. Would that be a fair summary?
No, because I disagree with that, because the first amended complaint does state that what was contemplated through the agreement and supported by many emails and text messages after, for years following this, is that once the Ely property sold, which it was sold at for sale at all relevant times, the remaining balance would be paid not later than when that Ely property was sold. And that's why the deed was provided to me as a form of collateral, or to give me some reassurance that there was some security or collateral for the remaining balance. And that's all addressed in the first amended complaint. The district judge did not address that in the dismissal order.
Mr. Dean, just to clarify, does your complaint, your amended complaint, identify who was the transferor in that quitclaim deed? And if my memory's correct, that it might reference the corporation, then again, we're talking about the potential corporate liability separate from Timothy Melby's personal liability for this agreement. Is that an accurate summary of?
I'm not sure. So I believe the complaint identifies that it's AdVentures that's the grantor of that deed and the title holder on the Ely property. And that is what the grantor on the deed is, AdVentures Inc.
That's why I asked the question though. How does that support your argument that Timothy Melby and his wife personally are responsible for this legal agreement contract?
Through a series of in-person meetings, emails, and text messages in the years from Dale Melby's death to up until early 2020, just a couple of years ago, in which he provided regular reassurances to me that this was going to be taken care of. There was contemplation that not later than when the Ely property was sold and those sale proceeds were available. And the reason for that is as the Elysian property sold, although some of my bill was paid down, my understanding, based on both conversations with Dale Melby and Tim Melby, is that AdVentures was funded, but it was land rich and money poor. And it wasn't until AdVentures sold this Ely property that it would have funds to pay down the remaining balance. And I think the reason for that is that potential claims against first the estate of Dale Melby and then later the estate of Marjorie Melby is that the sale proceeds from the Elysian properties, other than what was paid over to me, was transferred to Dale and Marjorie Melby themselves for their own living expenses, which I was okay with. I want to speak to the claims against AdVentures first. I did everything Minnesota law contemplates and requires for a creditor to preserve and not waive their claims. Tim Melby, although the notice of dissolution has been put forward that it's dissolution without notice to creditors, I was provided notice. The notice was sent to me in my capacity as a creditor and at the direction of an attorney. I then attached to the first amended complaint is an exhibit, and that exhibit is a timely claim that I filed with the registered agent of AdVentures, which is Tim Melby. And there's proof that was transmitted to him by email. That's at pages 12 and 13 of my addendum.
Mr. Dean, on that point, and again, we're looking at whether there's error in a district court's findings and memorandum, which are the findings and analysis are incorporated. There's no dispute here that there was the documents submitted, the court considered, which seemed to take us outside the realm of Rule 12 and more in a summary judgment, but specifically the document from the Secretary of State that indeed it was a no notice process of dissolution. My question for you is, how do we find error when in fact that is part of the record? And secondly, is there any law that prohibits in a no notice that a corporation nevertheless gives some form of a notice? It may not be the one that's in the statute laid out that you're referring to, the 7227, I think it is. But the bottom line is the court had in front of it the formal document saying which process was used. How could we not affirm that if that's part of what the district court had in its possession?
I understand that question, and I struggled with that as well in real time as these, when I received the notice and looked at the corporate dissolution statutes, I struggled with that as well. Under either theory, I correctly and properly preserved my claims. If this is governed by the notice to creditors statute of the, and this is at page 12 of my appellant's brief, I recite to the actual language of 302.7291. That's for corporations that do not give notice. And that provides that a creditor or claimant who does not file a claim or pursue a remedy in a legal or administrative proceeding within 2 years after the date of filing is SOL in effect. I did file a timely claim. That's the March 9th, 2020 Exhibit A to the first amended complaint at pages 12 and 13. So the claim was timely filed. And then as far as the alternative of pursuing a legal action, that was commenced in December of 2020, which is well within the 2 years. That's about halfway through the 2 year period. What defense counsel succeeded in persuading the court is that because the case wasn't actually filed with the district court until just a few days after the 2 year mark, that I was SOL because I missed the deadline. That's not what the corporation dissolution statute says. It's either you file a claim with the office registered agent of the corporation, which I did do within 90 days, or pursue a legal or legal administrative or arbitration proceeding within 2 years. I commenced my proceeding about 12 months afterwards, 1 year afterwards. Minnesota law, we don't commence cases by filing with the district court. It's commenced by service.
Mr. Dedane, what information did you provide to the district court in relation to commencement?
An affidavit of service. When the summons and complaint was filed, an affidavit of service was filed as well. And that is...
But in terms of this motion and your response to it, the motion to dismiss and your response to it in the district court's order, I don't see that as part of either the record that was submitted to the court, and therefore I don't see it in the court's analysis, and I didn't see it in your argument to the district court either, because you were focused on the notice, the earlier statute, and not the one that now you're referring to, the 7291.
Well, if you're asking what was the date that I pursued a legal action and was it within 2 years, that in the Register of Actions, that's index number 3, which is the Certificate of Personal Service, which was filed at the time that the summons and original complaint was filed. And the proof of service states by the server that it was served in December of 2020. That's when this case was commenced. And under the corporate dissolution statute, that's well within about 12 months before my 2 years expired. I want to switch gears to the alternative corporate dissolution statute, which is for corporations that do give notice, which I received that. And under that statute, that's the statute where a creditor can make a claim, and then the burden or the obligation, the ball is in then the corporation's court to either reject that claim within 30 days, or if they don't, then by statute, it's approved. So under either, I think what the court's question a few minutes ago is, if your honors conclude that this is properly under the statute that for corporations that do not give notice, even though I was provided notice, that the ship has sailed and I missed the boat. I respectfully disagree. I believe the record is abundantly clear that under either statutory scheme, I did everything that Minnesota law requires of a creditor to protect their rights. And I struggled with this as it happened because the notice of filing with the Secretary of State does say that the corporation is not giving notice to creditors. But I was provided a notice along with a correspondence that the attorney told me to send this to you. Why would it be sent to me if I wasn't a creditor of the corporation? So the record, including the affidavit of service of that commenced this under either subdivision, I did file a default judgment early on this, a motion for default. Adventures, the unknown distributees, they've never appeared in this action. So from my view, if the court does remand the proceeding, I should be allowed to proceed on renewing that motion for default, or in the alternative, at some point, I believe I'm entitled to summary judgment on the basis that I was given notice in my capacity as a known creditor. I made the timely claim, and then the corporate registered agent chose not to reject or object to that, so it's approved as a matter of law.
Very good. Your time has expired, but you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So now, counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brandon Schwartz. I represent Tim and Laurel Melby. May it please the court and counsel. I think what's to put this dispute in context, it's not a veil-piercing claim. It's not an estate claim. Instead, Mr. Dineen has brought claims individually against my clients. And to view this appropriately, I serve on the Minnesota Supreme Court General Rules Committee. And one of those rules is Rule 104. That requires a civil cover sheet to be filed in every civil case. The civil cover sheet, which evidences what Mr. Dineen's claims are, is set forth in the amended complaint, and I'll get to that, which is docket number 18, specifically says, claims relate to the balance on unpaid legal fees for work performed but not yet paid for, as had been agreed. That frames the issue first for the district court and now for this court, as we look at this amended complaint. And while Mr. Dineen touched on this, it's document number 12 of the addendum, it's referenced in paragraph 59 of his amended complaint, is this document that Mr. Dineen signed under penalty of perjury, declaring it to be a representation that is true and complete, that the entirety of this debt that he's claiming is now owed by my clients was actually owed by Adventures. And we get to that, we look at paragraph 3 of his amended complaint. It starts out with, beginning in 2006, plaintiff entered into a legal
practice. And if that's true, Mr. Schwartz, how is that claim against Ace Ventures untimely?
So 2 points first, Your Honor. I don't represent Adventures.
So you don't care?
I theoretically don't have a dog in that fight, so to speak. But we laid out in our brief before the district court and our brief before this court, which Mr. Dineen did not reply to, there is a difference between service and filing. And the statute references filing. Mr. Dineen served his original complaint in December of 2020, but then did not file it until 2021.
But Mr. Schwartz, just on that point, that same statute refers to or pursue a legal remedy. And that's the point Mr. Dineen makes. Isn't it true to pursue a legal remedy, you commence it, and to commence it, you serve it? And his point being that in the record, there is service within the 2 years. Would that not resolve, at least with regard to the corporation, that it's timely?
That's the argument that he made, but the statute specifically uses the word filed, and I believe the district court went through the correct process in analyzing that. And where the record gets,
but just to clarify, doesn't it do both? I'm just looking at it right now to pursue a claim. Known creditors or claimants at the time of the dissolution are filed. A creditor or claimant who does not file a claim or pursue a remedy. So don't we have two different methods, file a claim or pursue a remedy? Legally?
Yeah. And then the question becomes is when does the, you know, when does the case commence under the our rules of civil procedure? Because I think it uses the same terms of file. And where I think the record gets a little jumbled here. And I think, Judge Sleater, your point was, does this convert it to a motion for summary judgment versus a motion to dismiss? And the reason some of these documents, as it related to the articles of dissolution and what was or wasn't filed, was Mr. Dineen, after we originally brought our motion to dismiss, filed a motion to disqualify me and for sanctions. And so there was a different scope of documents there that the court looked at as it related to that issue. I'm focusing on the motion to dismiss under the Northern States Power case, 684 Northwest 2nd 45. Minnesota Supreme Court 2004, the court can look at and review documents that are referenced in the complaint or the amended complaint without converting it to a motion for summary judgment. I think that's what the district court appropriately did here in analyzing the scope of the issue and finding that there was no set of facts that could be introduced consistent with the amended complaint to give Mr. Dineen relief against my clients when he admits under penalty of perjury that the entirety of his claim is against AdVentures and not against Tim Melby or Laurel Melby.
Mr. Schwartz, I'm going to follow up an answer you gave to Judge Connolly that you do not represent the corporation. So my question, why would it not be proper to grant default judgment a party that doesn't appear? And here there is no appearance by the corporation. And even though there's a record of the corporation having been dissolved, what's the legal basis for a court to essentially grant a remedy to a non-existing party that, by as a matter of law, doesn't exist at all? And maybe I'm implying an answer I don't know. But normally, would you agree that if a party doesn't appear, default judgment's granted and you at least not directly have an interest in that, other than your clients personally?
Sure. I appreciate the question, Your Honor. Even in my experience, even if a party hasn't appeared and you file a motion for default judgment, the district court still undergoes the analysis as to whether there's a viable claim there. Have they timely responded or not? Depending on what the scope of the claim is, you have to provide the affidavit setting forth what your damages are, for instance. And we raised the issue in our brief that Mr. Dineen did not comply with the statutes, and the court agreed with our analysis of the dissolution procedure under Minnesota Chapter 302A and dismissed it. That, Your Honor, on the question of whether the district court properly or improperly denied the motion for default is viewed under the abuse of discretion standard. And I don't believe the district court abused its discretion when it looked at properly analyzed rule Minnesota Chapter 302A and dismissed it. Whether that's considered sua sponte or it was, because AdVentures didn't technically appear, I think it was correct in that analysis. And I do think that what Mr. Dineen acknowledged in his argument and what was acknowledged in the briefs and the amended complaint, Mr. Dineen could have filed claims against Dale Melby's estate. He could have filed claims against Marjorie Melby's estate. He chose not to. There was really, other than the fact that he's trying to substitute my clients for Dale and Marjorie, there was no reason to bring this claim against them. Simply serving as an officer of AdVentures doesn't put Tim Melby in the shoes of AdVentures such that he has to answer for the debts of AdVentures. That's basic corporate law, and that would throw our veil piercing jurisprudence on its head if that argument was adopted. And the argument about, well, there's these emails and other writings that evidence that Tim Melby agreed to step into the shoes of AdVentures, just like you hit the nail on the head. The deed that Mr. Dineen references, he had to acknowledge, was from AdVentures. It was not from my clients, but at every opportunity, he's tried to insert them and exchange them for AdVentures. We went through a very thorough analysis in our brief as to where we believe on each of these 10 different claims the elements were missing. I don't want to belabor that point. And I know that I still have 6 minutes, but we believe that the briefs here have established the
Mr. Schwartz, I'd like to go back to the whole filing of a claim issue. So under 302A-7291, you know, it says file a claim or pursue a legal remedy. So how do you file a claim under that statute?
I believe that you have to file an action with the district court.
Well, if that's true, though, then why does it say who does not file a claim or pursue a remedy in a legal? I mean, it's or, which would suggest filing a claim is something different than pursuing a legal remedy.
Correct, Your Honor. I believe that, and we cited the Camacho versus Todd and Leeser Holmes case. It's a 706 Northwest 2nd 49 from the Supreme Court 2005. And the reason for requiring that finality is, quote, the legislative process.
Well, you know, I'm all for finality. Believe me, there's no one who's more in favor of finality than I am. And believe me, you learn quickly at the Court of Appeals that there is no finality. We see people coming back decades later. But my question is, again, file a claim or pursue a remedy in a legal, administrative, or arbitration proceeding. Is filing a claim simply sending a letter to the Secretary of State, or is it sending it a letter to the last known address of the corporation? I mean, what does filing a claim mean, and how do you do that? Is it just writing a letter saying, hey, you owe me money?
Sure, Your Honor, I respect that question. I think to answer the question, I think if we turn back to 302A.727 subdivision 3, and it says claims against corporations that give notice, the legislature distinguishes between notice and filing here. And I think that the intent of the legislature there and 302A.7291 was filing meant actually filing a claim in district court to preserve the rights, whereas just sending a letter or just sending a claim, that's giving notice. And notice is distinguishable from filing. And I think that is supported by the Camacho case that talked about the whole purpose of this 302A dissolution procedure was to provide finality for these corporations. And it even says, dissolution of a corporation is akin to the death of an individual and abates all litigation against that corporation. So I think if we don't interpret it, that's the intent and in fact, the plain language, that it would run afoul of the Camacho case.
But Mr. Schwartz, we'd have to add those words to the language. Clearly, they don't. You have to admit they don't say or define where it is to be filed. But after the or, we're familiar with that to commence a legal proceeding. We know how that starts, but we don't know how the prior starts. Would it be safe to say that the legislature has said file it somewhere, file a claim? And it's undisputed here that a claim was filed. Now, it might have been under the other statute, but indeed a claim, at least it wasn't at a Rule 12 stage because there's no answer. It was filed.
But I would say that it was served. A notice of a claim was served versus filed.
You're focusing on service for a complaint. I think I agree with Judge Sleater. I think, and I don't know, maybe we're splitting hairs, but it seems to me you can file a claim by not starting a lawsuit. I agree, you know, there's the rules of civil procedure govern, like, for statute of limitations, filing in service and all that, and when a lawsuit commences. But I mean, why isn't just filing a claim just means sending a letter saying, and I don't know, maybe you send it to the Secretary of State's office or the last known agent or both or everywhere, I suppose, you know, file it everywhere. Why isn't that enough?
Well,
isn't that what Mr. Dineen did in this case?
Mr. Dineen provided this affidavit he signed under penalty of perjury. I agree with that, and that's encompassed within the amended complaint. I think when you look at 302A.727, even subdivision one, when a notice of intent to dissolve has been filed with the Secretary of State. So again, it's using the word filing. And then it goes through the process of what the contents of the notice, and it distinguishes between notice to creditors and filing the claim. I think Mr. Dineen arguably gave notice. I don't think he filed it. And again, Your Honor,
Was it your position file only means starting a lawsuit and filing it in district court?
I believe that that's correct, and I believe that that's supported by the rules of civil procedure.
So it would not include filing it with, apart from a civil lawsuit, filing it in a bankruptcy proceeding.
Well, that's again, that would, I believe, be filing, because that's filing it with the court of action seeking to solidify or memorialize the debt that's owed. That's again with the court versus
getting. So you're saying if I simply send a letter to the corporation's last known address or the last known address of its officers, saying you owe me 10 grand, that's not enough. I have not filed a claim. Is that correct, Mr. Schwartz?
Yes, because you're giving notice to the corporation, and then the corporation from that point forward, if you look at subdivision three, can either pay that debt, can pay part of that debt, can give notice back to the creditor that there's not sufficient funds. And then at that point, the creditor can file the claim with the court seeking to preserve their right to recovery on that. I think that's the two terms are not interchangeable. I think they're distinct from each other. And I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Then counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you. since we're drilling in deep here to the two companion statutes of notice and not notice, 72.91 and file a claim, it's not in the definition sections of 302A, which would be helpful, but it's not there. In 0.7291, as your honors have already identified, it contemplates either file a claim or pursue a legal remedy. But then as far as the ambiguity that you're honing in on, if you then turn to the companion statute for corporations that do give notice, which is 302A.727, that contemplates the corporation that gives notice to creditors and claimants has 30 days from the receipt of each claim filed. That's my March 9th filing. That clears up any ambiguity in my favor that
Mr. Dineen, what did you do on March 9th?
Yes, Your Honor. Exhibits page 12 and 13 of my addendum have the what I consider the formal claim that I prepared and submitted to the registered agent of AdVentures within the time contemplated under the statute after having been provided notice of the dissolution. And page 12 is that formal claim form. And then page 13 is the email transmittal of it as evidence that it was sent and saying, if you want this in some other form, let me know and I'll get it to you.
So you emailed that to whom?
To the last known registered agent of AdVentures, Timothy Melby, at the registered address and per the information on record with the Secretary of State office. Mr. Schwartz, you know, as attorneys, we all try to come up with clever and new arguments. And Mr. Schwartz takes that to another level. And you've heard an example of it here today. The exhibit, when he talks about the civil cover page that I signed under penalty of perjury, his argument is that I only made my claim against AdVentures and perhaps Dale Melby, but that I waived any other claim to any other party in the world. That's not what happened there. That was for a limited purpose. Both the claim itself, Exhibit 12, and the civil cover sheet, those have limited purposes. And there's nothing in either of those documents under penalty of perjury or otherwise where I waived any claims against any other third parties. The notice of claim against the corporation, there would be no purpose for me to identify any other parties other than the corporation. It's for a limited purpose. The civil cover sheet, it's not to limit the scope of a proceeding. It's to give the court and realistically, I think the court administrators a sense of what the case is about for their administrative purposes. So And these are the exact same, and that's, I'm not necessarily taking issue with that as far as that being so critical to the outcome today. I'm pointing that out as an example that that's what, I think that's what misled the district court into coming to the determination that it did. If your honors affirm this decision, then in essence, what you're doing is allowing fraud that continued over a number of years to be allowed, that it's allowed under Minnesota law, which, and that fraud would be in the form of, if Tim Melby never made any representations to me and we didn't have any contact in these intervening years, then we wouldn't be here today. But that's not what happened. I took the steps that I deemed appropriate to protect myself. And under Minnesota law, that should be recognized. I want to say this as tactfully as I
did. At any time, Mr. Dineen, did in any of the correspondence or emails back and forth between him and you, did he ever say, don't worry, I am personally going to be responsible for this?
Yes, and there's a portion of the 2019 email that's recited in it's in the briefs and it's in my amended complaint. And that was when we were contemplating, should I make a claim against your mom's estate?
What exactly did he say?
He says that I'm negotiating with the, says, no, don't file a claim against my mom's estate. There's not enough money there. And I'm negotiating with the estate to take care of, this has been referred to as the
illusion. Right, and that's what I thought it said. But did he say, don't worry, I personally guarantee this debt will be paid, or something like that, that language, where it's, where we get to the personal liability as opposed to the corporation's liability.
Yes, there's a follow-up exchange of emails on the heels of that one that I just talked about, where I warned him that you're charting into taking personal responsibility for
it. And did he say, yep, I agree?
No, he said, okay. Thank you for all the good work you've done.
Okay.
He didn't object or disagree.
You are out of time, Mr. Dineen, but if you want to wrap up, any final comments, you may do so.
Just a final comment. I had no history with Judge Johnson before this case. I've got no reason to think there was something personal in play here. This decision was issued on September 20th.
You did suggest, didn't you, that the wool was pulled over his eyes. I saw that in your motion to reconsideration.
I believe that it was, and I didn't intend that as a personal attack, but I believe defense counsel has gone beyond the pale with clever arguments and splitting hairs on words. The final point I want to make is I don't have any reason to believe there's some personal thing here between the judge and this case. Maybe he didn't like this case. The decision was issued on September 21st, 2 days earlier on September 19th. This honorable court, you issue on every Monday your opinion sets. As attorneys, we keep an eye on those. My own practice is I always skim down them looking for, I'm not interested in the affirmances so much as the reversals. There's more to learn there usually. On September 19th, and those are always a minority of the cases too. So as far as clicking and reading them, there's usually one or two of those to read instead of all of them. September 19th, there were two reversals from this court, both on Judge Johnson. One was on a motion to dismiss, the other one on a motion for summary judgment. Neither of those cases have anything to do with this case. I'm not suggesting they do. I'm just bringing up that I don't sense there's anything personal here. Maybe there is something else happening as far as what did happen here, and that I asked, relying on your honors now to please do
justice. Is your point that Judge Johnson doesn't have a good batting average up here? Is that kind of where we're going?
No, I don't. Maybe he didn't like this case, or and we all have bad days, judges included. So I'm just bringing that up. That to me, that was, and I didn't find those two reversals after the fact. I read those on Monday. And I'm waiting for the decision on this case, and then 2 days later get this case. So just as a footnote, for that may be worth nothing, I acknowledge that, but I wanted to identify that as an incidental point. Thank you.
Thank you to counsel. And for the record, regardless of our decision, you got us on a good day. So you each have a good day as well. We appreciate your answers to our questions, and we'll issue a ruling within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. Great. Have a good day.
Thank you.
For a response, so we'll have no appearance from the respondent in this third of three matters. Judges Conley and Flory joining me, Judge Sleater, on March 9. This third case, A221067, Jessica Marie Bloom, petitioner respondent. Robert Lyle Blum is the appellant. And counsel, you can see perhaps the 15 minutes in the corner of your screen. You can keep an eye on that. And since I assume you will not be disagreeing with yourself, you won't be allowed any rebuttal today since there's no response. And so we are recording the proceeding. No additional separate recording is allowed, but it will be on the Judicial Branch's website within 24 hours. And so, Ms. Olson, if you would identify yourself for the record, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michelle Olson, and I represent the appellant Robert Blom in this matter. This is an order for protection matter outside of or within Watonwan County, and we are asking for a reversal of an issuance of an order for protection. The reason we are making this request is upon review of the record, as well as the findings that were made by the district court, an order for protection should not have been found, and a reversal would be the only remedy at this stage. As there were enough findings, the findings are just improper as a matter of law. Specifically, in reviewing this type of case, we are to look at it under an abuse of discretion. So, meaning in this situation, we have to look at the findings that were made within the document itself and if they then would qualify. If they don't qualify either by law or it is a complete improper finding under the record, then it would be an abuse of discretion. Here, we believe as a matter of law specifically that the findings made do not qualify under the requirements of an order for protection. Minnesota Statute 518B.01 Subdivision 4 lists what can be defined as domestic abuse under an order for protection statute. Here, it would not, what the court found were acts of domestic abuse are as follows. One, Mr. Blom became aggressive with respondent during an altercation in 2012 and was arrested for it, resulting in a disorderly conduct charge. Two, came into the party's marital home while they were separated and left a note inside the home frightening her. Three, swinging a garden hoe around outside of the marital home trying to get in, which frightened respondent by threatening to tear up the garden. In looking at those three, because they are the only parts that were cited as acts.
Ms. Olson, did she say she was frightened by any of your client's actions swinging the hall?
She talked about her fear, but in further detail of what actually made her frightened or what her fear was, it was in regards to him potentially harming himself. And she said, I don't know what he was going to do. So it wasn't a particularized fear of potentially harm to her. She made more of a particularized fear actually of him harming himself or him killing himself with the garden hoe incident. And then she also suggested that she was afraid he was going to destroy property. And when I clarified that with her, it was tearing up the garden, which is why the court cites that specific quote.
Why isn't that enough?
Well, one, Your Honor, tearing up a garden is not a qualification under the order for potential.
Well, no, but if I'm swinging a hoe out, you know, I'm swinging a hoe out outside of someone's house, and then I use that hoe and I kind of, you know, destroy some property in front of the house. Why isn't, you know, apart from what she said, I understand, I see your cross-examination about that, but why aren't those actions enough to objectively put the person in the house who sees that to be afraid of me with the hoe? I'm swinging the hoe, I'm destroying property. Obviously, you know, no one in their right mind is going to go outside to see, gee, I wonder if he'll hit me. Why isn't that enough objectively to indicate fear of harm?
I think there's more to it, Your Honor, that that is somewhat of a simplification that the district court held. However, actually, in discussing it, there was no property actually ever destroyed. There was no property actually ever discussed that he was swinging or striking anything. When it was discussed of swinging a hoe, it was apparently up in the air. So what was discussed was that the hoe was being held up in the air. She said swinging, but she never described actually the action. She never actually described any property being harmed. She had the door locked. So in these objective circumstances, there would be no fear of physical bodily harm because there was no way for Mr. Blum to even get up to her, to get in hold of her. And she admits that he never made any sort of threat or attempted to make a threat to her. She said he attempted to get into the home. And in reviewing the finding of that, which the court doesn't necessarily find he did anything wrong, he tried to open the door. But from there, nothing further happened. And the police interaction that was described had nothing to do with it. Again, she said most of her fear was of that incident, of the hoe incident, actually was him harming himself, not her. She
but didn't also, as I read the record, this had in context, this happened the day after he had come into the home while she was sleeping to see if she was sleeping with another individual and left her a note telling her he had been in there observing her sleep and apparently glad that she wasn't with someone else. She then called the police to report that. And the next day is when he shows up at the house swinging this hoe outside the door wanting to get in. If you look at that in context, it seems frightening.
It certainly, I would agree, it seems odd behavior. I would not necessarily say objectively that's frightening in the context of—
No, but from an abuse of discretion standard and saying that the district court erred, that did not seem to be an unreasonable interpretation of the evidence from the district court judge's point of view under that standard of review.
It is, unfortunately, it is an improper interpretation because her own statements do not state that she was necessarily frightened of him physically harming her. She never actually says that. She says, I don't know what happened. I was afraid of him harming himself. The note, she admits, has no type of threat. And because this is an order for protection, not a harassment restraining order, we are significantly more limited in what can be constituting that. She does not, there is no finding of physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, which could be an attempt, but you have to have that specific, particularized intent for it. And merely writing a note and coming into his own marital home, which he was entitled to, they had no order that said he couldn't be there. He is a lawful owner of the home. He came into the home, did nothing to her. And she admits that. She freely admits that. Her fear is that he came into the home. She was more upset that he just was there and she didn't like it. And then in the second instance, again, with this garden hoe, she admits he never attempted to strike her. He never came charging at her. That's not what happened. She was in the home the entire time locking the door. He came out and around from a garage with this implement. And he wasn't swinging it towards anyone at all. She doesn't actually say he ever swung it towards her or tried to intimidate her in that way. Her fear was solely based on him being there physically, which he was entitled to be.
Ms. Olson, I mean, you know, we do sort of apply common sense up here as best we can. I mean, Judge Flores just talked about the letter incident, and now he's outside of her house swinging a hoe back and forth. And granted, I understand she said, you know, she was protected by the house, but what if it had been a bat? What if he was swinging a bat back and forth in front of her house so that she could see it? Do you think that's grounds for an OFP?
I think there would potentially need to be more facts for an OFP.
What more than that?
If he was, if in that specific instance with a bat, if he was coming towards the house with the bat, swinging the bat at her or attempting to break in to the home with the bat, that I think would create more of a fear and would be more in line with the requirements under an OFP. Here with the hoe incident, the swinging didn't happen by the door. That isn't what happened. He was swinging in the open air, which is what she described. And he later testified it was because he was going to work on the garden. Again, I'm taking solely what had been written in the finding. He didn't swing at her. He didn't swing at the door with the implement. He didn't do anything near that. The judge just claims that he was swinging it in the air and it to potentially, and I want to make sure I'm citing this correctly, that basically he was intentionally trying to destroy their garden. That's what the swinging was about, which destroying property maybe could be an issue, but not in this particular case, because the court readily admits the swinging, the thing that he was doing was towards the garden, not towards Miss Blom. Miss Blom never cited that. She never even claimed that he was doing it. She made a lot of statements about it, though.
Well, let me ask you this then. Again, viewing this from the from an abuse of discretion standard, why isn't the fact that the court cites to this, I think it was a 2012 incident, and you look at the Thompson case, there is no temporal component to it. So I think the court could consider that. And the evidence that the court heard, I think, upon your or whoever's cross-examination of the respondent, that the conduct there that resulted in the finding was that he slammed her up against the wall multiple times. Sounds like an assault, or at least something that would instill fear in someone. And the court made a finding of domestic abuse based on that evidence, which to me indicates the court at a minimum implicitly accepted her explanation of that. Why isn't that enough to overcome the abuse of discretion standard here? How do we find the court abused its discretion when that was the evidence before the court?
I think it's more of a careful reading of the actual finding is needed here. That finding, the 2012 incident you're describing, the finding the court made isn't that he slammed her or anything like that. And I don't believe it's even implicitly that. The finding is very explicit. He became aggressive with respondent during an altercation in 2012 and was arrested for it, resulting in a disorderly conduct charge.
The evidence was the aggressiveness was slamming her against the wall multiple times. I mean, that's what she answered your questions, I presume, during the hearing. And that's what she said was the basis for that.
She said that there was they were yelling and fighting with each other. She claimed that there was slamming. When asked, was he charged with an assault? She said, no, he was not charged with an assault. And I believe there was further indication that there was no evidence of this slamming. While she did testify to it, she has the burden to prove by preponderance of the evidence that the slamming actually occurred. And if the court found that slamming had occurred, that she had been struck in some way, it should have been outlined more explicitly because there are other incidents. And what he actually cites to more is the disorderly conduct, which is them fighting, them brawling, not even fighting and brawling. It was that they engaged in abusive behavior with each other, which my client had been charged with, not convicted of. And that is why this is very unique in the court could have made that specific finding of slamming if that's what the court found to have been the incident, but it's aggressive behavior. Aggressive behavior is not cited at all within 518B. It's physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. That is not what has been shown. Infliction of fear of imminent physical harm. Again, a disorderly conduct does not create that. And the court was very specific in that finding. That's why we're not saying that that there weren't enough finding. It's just that these findings are improper for the definition and that Ms. Blom did not prove her case, though these three incidents are cited. It is Ms. Blom did not want him there. And these incidents that are related to it just don't qualify for an order for protection. Maybe other relief could have been qualified for, but not here, not with this specific type of relief. And the implications of having an order for protection on your record when you're dealing with certain disputes, including involving children, which they have, that this is something that is necessary to have a reversal because it can significantly impact him in future and his ability to have this. And again, I don't think I'd be standing here today with you if the court had said slammed her into the wall or something of that effect, because that would qualify. But this does not the findings that were made.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. And we will take the matter under advisement. We appreciate the answers you had to our questions today and your briefing. We will issue an order within the statutory period of 90 days. We will now be adjourning from our oral matters and proceeding on our non-oral. So you have a good day, ma'am.
Thank you.